Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back to my channel for another episode in my midweek mystery series, where today I have yet another case updates video. I think this is my third or fourth updates video in the last year, and like, that's why we do what we do here on this channel. Case updates are what we are hoping and praying for. Movements in cold cases that bring us one step closer to a case being solved, or in the case of some of these, one of these, actually being solved. I love making these case updates video, and I love how engaged you guys always are with them. I never get as many comments as I do on these videos, and it's always just so wonderful to see people actively rooting for closure, for answers. I'm rambling now, but you get my point. Today I have so many updates to give you. Some of them are bigger than others, but let's get into it. As always, I'll leave links in the description box to each of the original videos, so if you want to go and refresh yourself on the full details of a case, then you can go and do that. And if you know of any updates and cases I've covered that I haven't mentioned here, then please do leave a comment and let me know. Chances are I've missed it entirely, so I'd love to know any information that you have. Also, you may recall in my last video I uploaded like 2 weeks ago now, I was in like the beginning stages of what I didn't know then, but I do know now, would be a horrendous, horrendous illness. It is now 2 weeks later. I literally haven't uploaded in 2 weeks because I was so ill, which is unheard of for me. And I'm still bunged up. My throat's still a bit sore. I'm very coughy. I'm very like just nasally and sinusy. I feel better within myself, but my head apparently hasn't got the memo. So if I do still sound a bit like gross and nasally, then I apologise, but that's why. But I just can't face having another week where I've not got a video uploaded. I never miss uploads. So that's how ill I really was. It wasn't COVID. I really, really thought it was, and I was devastated because we were due to go on holiday. Luckily, it wasn't COVID, so we still managed to go to Dubrovnik for a week. Had a lovely time. I actually really think the sun and like fresh air helped us recover because both me and my girlfriend had it awfully. But yeah, besides the point, but if I sound really gross, that is why. Apologies. So first up, we have some news in the Kendrick Johnson case, and sadly it's probably not the news that most people wanted to hear. 17-year-old Kendrick Johnson was found dead in the gymnasium of his high school, Lowndes High School in Valdosta, Georgia, on the 11th of January 2013, so almost 9.5 years ago. The scene of his death was a very strange one. He was found headfirst in the centre of a vertical rolled up wrestling mat, and the following autopsy showed that he had died from positional asphyxia. He basically suffocated to death because of the awkward position of his body, and the case was ruled as an accidental death. As you can imagine, people, especially Kendrick's family, have had a lot of questions and doubts about this over the years. I think we can all agree, no matter what, that it was a very strange death. The authorities said that Kendrick had fallen into the mat whilst trying to reach for his shoes that had been left at the bottom by another student. They shared shoes for gym class, and he basically found himself stuck in the process. But there have been rumours of other students being involved and the authorities being involved in a lengthy cover-up to protect said students and their parents. A second and third autopsy both showed blunt force trauma as the cause of death, as opposed to positional asphyxia. I'm pretty sure, as I filmed my original video on this case, a second local investigation into the death had just been opened up as of the 10th of March 2021. For this second investigation, the Justice Department basically turned all of its investigative material over to the Sheriff's Office, including grand jury testimony, federal autopsy reports, and additional digital evidence. The sheriff said that he spent 15 months reading every page but still couldn't find any criminal action whatsoever. I must say, I do have my doubts as to whether just rereading the criminal files counts as a complete reinvestigation of this case, especially when the sheriff, now admitting their original investigation was flawed, would reflect very badly on him and the department. I'm not saying I have any particular opinion either way here. This case is such a complex one with so many things to consider, but this reinvestigation does seem like, I don't know, like rushed. I don't think I'd call it a full reopening of this case.
Kendrick's parents are determined that something more than an accident led to their son's death, and after Sheriff Polk's announcement once again that it was an accident, they basically called him a liar and continued to state that Kendrick was murdered. In a news release, Polk said, "Because of these statements, I am personally, with my own funds, offering a reward of $500,000 to anyone who comes forward with information that results in the arrest and conviction of a person for the alleged murder of Kendrick Johnson at Lowndes High School." I think to prove a point that he is so sure it was an accident. But Kendrick's father, Kenneth Johnson, has said, "You can't do an investigation with the same investigators who covered it up. They're not going to uncover something that they covered up." I really do feel the Johnsons' pain in this, and if they are correct and that something has been covered up by the Sheriff's Office, then Kenneth very much does have a point here. But I'm not sure what their next step is. They are determined though and not giving up, so I'm sure this won't be the last update I have to share in Kendrick's case. I really would urge you to go and watch the full video for a full overview of this case, because I simply can't do all the details justice in this quick update. Next up, I have an update in the case of the Doodler, a case I covered way back in January 2019. It's really strange for me to go back and watch that video because I'm trying really carefully to talk about a case I'm really, really passionate about, a case that's centred on the LGBTQ+ community, without outing myself. And look at me now, poor baby Georgia. Anyway, the Doodler was the name given to a still unidentified serial killer who operated in San Francisco between 1974 and 1976. The Doodler is a serial killer that most haven't heard of. He operated at the peak of serial killers in the 70s, and whilst most of these serial killers are still spoken about today, like the Golden State Killer, Ted Bundy, the Zodiac, and so many more, you don't really hear about the Doodler, and that's mostly because of his victims, gay men, like white gay men. At the time, the media in San Francisco didn't really care about this. They barely reported on the crimes, at least not as much as they would have done with other victims, and that's reflected in the media coverage ever since, it seems. The Doodler got his name because of the fact he drew sketches of his victims on cocktail napkins, potentially using that to draw them in as a conversation starter. He also told a surviving victim that he was studying to be a cartoonist. The Doodler would lure young men to secluded areas under the guise of sexual hookups, and then their beaten bodies would be found the next morning. The suspected killer was described as a black man between 19 and 25 years old, with a medium complexion and smooth skin, between 5'11 and 6', and lanky in appearance. Apparently, there is one very strong potential suspect who is still alive today, as far as I can find, last interviewed by police in 2018, but we don't know his name or any information about him. It's always been said that there were 5 known victims of the Doodler, found between January 1974 to June 1975, on or near Ocean Beach, but new investigation has uncovered a potential 6th victim. 52-year-old Warren Andrews was a victim of an assault and battery on the 27th of April 1975, found unconscious beneath overhanging brush at Lands End near Golden Gate Park, but he never woke up. He died of his injuries 7 weeks later. Like the rest of the Doodler victims, he was a white, gay male, but Warren was ever considered a victim because his death was unlike the rest. He was beaten with a rock and a tree branch, whilst the rest of the Doodler victims were mostly stab wounds. He was never considered a potential Doodler victim until 2021, when police investigators and reporters from the San Francisco Chronicle looked deeply into his case, finding more than enough similarities to link him to the Doodler. He was found at an outdoor gay hookup spot not far from where another Doodler victim was found a few weeks later, and friends and family have confirmed they strongly, strongly believe he was gay and closeted. The violence of the attack suggests a rage killer, as do the rest of the Doodler victims. As the Chronicle writes, the main thing that doesn't fit is the murder weapon, but it's believed that in the struggle the Doodler may have lost his knife over a nearby cliff and grabbed the tree branch and a rock to finish the job. On January 27th, it was also announced by San Francisco police they are doubling the already standing reward to $200,000 for any information leading to the capture and conviction of the Doodler. The announcement of this reward came 48 years to the day after the first victim was found in 1974. It's also strongly believed that there may have been other victims, maybe as many as 14 or 15, as well as survivors of the Doodler, survivors who never reported an attack at the time because of fear of the police. Being gay, there was a strong chance you would just be brushed off, or potentially even arrested under sodomy laws if you admitted you were going to a secluded area with another man for sexual relations. These people still might not have come forward because of the lingering fear, or perhaps they're still closeted, but police are urging them to come forward even if it's anonymously. Reading between the lines here, and I may very well be wrong, it seems like they are set on this one suspect. They just need to have the final piece of the puzzle to make an arrest, and that's what they're looking for here. The one piece of information that will sort of pull everything together. But like I said, that's just me reading between the lines. The lead investigator on this case since 2017 is Dan Cunningham, and in 2021 he found evidence from Warren's crime scene that is currently undergoing DNA testing. And he's followed leads from eastern and southern parts of the USA as well, where it's believed the doodler might also have killed. He's also found new evidence in the case of another doodler victim called Frederick Cappin, who was found in May 1975. And also, I can't believe I didn't find this out sooner, but last summer the San Francisco Chronicle released a new 8-part podcast titled The Doodler, following this investigation, old and new, and I'm 100% going to make it my next listen when I'm at the stables in the morning. This case is one that is so close to being solved, and I truly believe it will be within the next couple of years, hopefully sooner if this DNA evidence comes through, or if more surviving victims come through with fresh information. Anyone with any information regarding this case is asked to contact the Cold Case Investigators, for which I'll leave details in the description box. If you know of anyone who may have been involved in the gay scene in San Francisco in the 1970s, please share this video or this information with them. Next up, I have a not so positive update in the Susie Lamplew case from over here in the UK. Susie was a 25-year-old estate agent who was reported missing on the 28th of July 1986 from Fulham in London. In her diary, there was an appointment for a house viewing on Sherald's Road with a man named Mr. Kipper, and she's never been seen since. Her body has never been found, and no killer has ever officially been apprehended, although it is widely believed that a man called John Cannon is the one responsible for her disappearance. Susie was declared dead, presumed murdered, 7 years after. John Cannon bears a striking resemblance to a man Susie was seen with on the day she vanished, as well as his prison nickname being none other than Mr. Kipper, due to his preference for wearing Kipper-style ties. He was imprisoned for murdering 29-year-old Shirley Banks 15 months after Susie disappeared, and he is widely considered to be a psychopath. Investigators operate under the assumption that he has many other victims. He also joked to a former girlfriend that he knew where Susie was buried. Again, if you want to hear about this case in full detail, then please go and watch my video on it. In the early 2000s, there was a full reinvestigation into whether Cannon could be responsible for Susie's murder, but the Crown Prosecution Service decided there was insufficient evidence to charge him. Regardless, in November 2002, the police held a press conference and said they did believe him responsible. Do you know how sure you've got to be about something like that to hold a whole press conference to announce it? It's incredibly rare for police to do. Anyway, the news in this case that John Cannon is officially eligible for parole as of this year, and he will be appealing to be freed. If the parole board agree, he will be moved to an open jail where he can make trips into the local community and make attempts to rejoin society before being officially freed under parole. This is a clearly dangerous man. I really hope the parole board side against it, and hopefully they will do, but this is a very real possibility. Even if John Cannon isn't responsible for Susie's murder, which we don't know for sure, he was given 3 life sentences for murder, attempted kidnapping and rape, amongst other things. He is dangerous and could soon be free. So if you fancy kicking up a fuss, feel free. Brianna Maitland was 17 years old when she went missing from Montgomery, Vermont on the night of the 19th to the 20th of March 2004. She worked as a dishwasher at a restaurant, the Black Lantern Inn in Montgomery, and left work at around 11:20pm that night, last seen by a co-worker getting into her car and driving away. Her last shift was uneventful, nothing different or unusual happened. Brianna was her usual self. The next morning, Vermont State Police received a report of an abandoned car, a green 1985 Oldsmobile Delta, found in very strange circumstances. The car was found on the property known locally as the Old Dutchman Barn, less than 2 miles from the inn where Brianna worked. The car was at an odd angle, crashed into the building, but as if it had been reversed into it. The rear bumper was stuck on the foundation of the house. The rear tyres were off the ground and the car was stuck. But there was nothing to indicate that the car had skidded off the road or the driver had lost control. The doors were unlocked and the keys were missing. A couple of days later, her mum went to the police to report Brianna as missing and went to the station to drop off some photographs of Brianna, at which point she showed a photo of this car and they confirmed that this was their daughter's car, it was Brianna's. Despite this very strange scene, it was at first thought that Brianna had run away, as it frustratingly always is, but it was later determined that she could have been a victim of foul play. A week after her disappearance, police returned to the scene with dogs for a canine search and found an item of interest on the ground near where the car had been, from which they were able to pull DNA. They didn't know for sure if this was related to Brianna's disappearance or not, but the DNA profile was entered into CODIS anyway and compared with 11 people of interest, but no match was found. However, in autumn 2020, the state police sent the samples to Othram, an incredible forensic sequencing lab based in Texas, to see if they could conduct their magic and get any further answers. They wanted to generate a lead using this DNA evidence using genealogical research, essentially tracing through a family tree using DNA. After months of further investigation, police located and obtained DNA samples from candidate donors, which were sent to a Vermont forensic lab for testing, and it was confirmed that one of the individuals matched the DNA found on the item near Brianna's car. As the lead investigator, Sergeant Angela Barker, has said, this doesn't mean they've identified a suspect, but it is a potential lead in the case, which is much, much more than they've had before. That's kind of where this new information ends for now, but I'm going to be keeping a very close eye on this case going forward to see if anything more comes out. I refuse to believe that this is just where this will end. I assume they're conducting further investigation, and they're just not announcing exactly what this new lead is. Next up, we have further information in the Madeleine McCann case, which I know feels never ending, but either in my last update video or maybe the one before that, I spoke about a potential new suspect in Germany and I have a lot more information to share on that. I don't really think you need much of a synopsis on Madeleine's case, but for the sake of it, she was a British 3-year-old girl who was probably abducted from her family's holiday home in the Algarve region of Portugal. It is probably the biggest case ever in the UK, 15 years on, and you'll still see Madeleine's face on the front cover of the newspaper fairly often. So in the last update I did about Madeleine's case, I spoke about a person of interest who I'm pretty sure was still unnamed at that point, maybe we just had his first name. But we now know he was a German paedophile named Christian Bruckner. He lived in the Algarve between 1995 and 2007 and was last month named as an official suspect by German and Portuguese investigators. This is the first time Portuguese prosecutors have identified a formal suspect since clearing Kate and Jerry McCann, Madeleine's parents, back in 2007. Investigators have said that Bruckner has no alibi, but he has since said that he does have an alibi because he was busy having sex in his camper van with a young German woman. It doesn't seem like they've been able to verify it with the woman in question yet. I don't know if they're still trying to trace her or what's going on there. Bruckner has told authorities that he drove the woman to the Faro airport one day after Madeleine disappeared and they were stopped and photographed at a police roadblock en route. He's also said that the woman in question was stopped and arrested at the airport for being in possession of pepper spray, which should make it a lot easier for the authorities to track her, or so you'd think. Bruckner is currently serving a 7-year prison sentence in Germany for raping a 72-year-old woman at the Praia de Luz resort, the same place Madeleine was, back in 2005. And in 2019, a woman from Ireland identified him as the man who sexually assaulted her in Portugal. And he's been convicted of several sexual abuse crimes against children dating all the way back to 1994. So this definitely isn't an innocent guy we're dealing with here. If he was indeed in Praia de Luz at the time of Madeleine's disappearance, then that's more than enough reason to look into him further. Investigators have said that they can place him near the McCann's holiday apartment on the night Madeleine disappeared as his mobile phone pinged off a nearby tower. He received a call between 7:31 and 8:02 p.m. Madeleine disappeared between 9 and 10 p.m. Out of a CNN article released literally 3 hours ago on the day I was writing this, so on the 6th of May 2022, the lead investigator on the case has told Portuguese media that investigators have found new evidence that connects Bruckner to the crime, but stresses that the investigation is still ongoing. He says, "We are sure he is the murderer of Madeleine McCann." The evidence in question is apparently not forensic though, and from what I can gather, a search of Bruckner's VW camper van unearthed items belonging to Maddie. We do not know what the item is, but there is speculation it might have been threads from the pyjamas that she was wearing that night, but I'm pretty sure that would be classed as forensic evidence. Forensic evidence is defined as evidence obtained by scientific methods, and to identify threads consists of scientific testing surely, but maybe I'm thinking too far into it. Once again, I'm certain this is not going to be the last we hear in this case. As you can tell, the news is coming out thick and fast about this new evidence, so I'll be sure to update once again in my next case updates video. Could we really be one step closer to finally solving the case of Madeleine McCann? I don't know, it seems almost too good to be true, doesn't it? I feel like I've already been talking for ages, this video is going to be so long, but I still have some massive case updates to report on. Next up, we're going to talk about a fairly decent update in the Mr. Krull case. This is a video I filmed a couple of years ago now, and it got so many views. I think the thumbnail of this one really drew people in because it's so haunting. This is literally the only composite sketch we have of the suspect, a man in an all-black balaclava with only slits for eyes in his mouth. The name Mr. Krull refers to an Australian case from the late 80s and early 90s in which he kidnapped and raped three girls before releasing them, and he's strongly suspected in the murder of 13-year-old Carmaine Chan as well. The previous three cases can all be connected due to similar descriptions from the victims who were all released and survived, but of course Carmaine was unable to give her first-hand account. But the conditions of her kidnap were close enough that it's always been assumed she fell victim to the same man. It seems that recently there's been a new potential suspect discussed in this case, but it's not official and most media just describe it as a potential breakthrough, but I figured it's worth sharing. I'm going to be completely honest with you here and say that most of the articles I could find around this new suspect were locked behind an Australian paywall, so even with my VPN I couldn't access them. And there's little information I could find about this elsewhere, but a name that's now come up is that of Norman Normie Lee. First revealed by retired homicide detective Ron Iddles in the Australian True Crime podcast. Iddles was reportedly told by a well-known crook who was dying of cancer back in 2003 that Mr. Krull had lived in a house under the flight path in Eltham, and by that point he had died. According to Iddles, this person of interest was a successful businessman who visited the Chan's family restaurant regularly, and he was also known to be a cross-dresser. I do always twitch when serial killers are referred to as cross-dressers as if it's an inherently bad thing or just a sign of a serial killer when someone doesn't adhere to the gender binary, but it could be important identifying information in a case like this, so here we go. It was on the 31st of April this year, 2022, when a journalist with the Herald Sun called Andrew Rule named Iddles' informant as Alfred Hugh Gay and the person he was referring to as Normie Lee. Lee was a notorious armed robber who was shot dead by police at a crime scene in July 1992, which was just 3 months after the discovery of Carmen's body, although well over a year since she was abducted. Interestingly, after Lee died, Mr. Krull never reoffended. Lee apparently confessed to Gay that he had murdered Carmen, and Gay had also said that Lee had a collection of school dresses and owned a house that matched the description given by the surviving victims. Iddles said that this information was passed on to the police at the time, but it was never followed up. I assume they will be following up now though. But that's not all I have for the Mr. Krull case. New details have come out suggesting that the suspect may have been linked to the city's electrical industry, which is very interesting as a lot of the previous evidence has suggested he might have been an employee of a school, with most of his crimes taking place during school holidays. This new information does not come from the police, so please do bear that in mind, but instead from a Channel 9 TV series called Under Investigation, where Cutting Edge Technology revealed a new map linking the three victims, showing that they were all abducted near or found at electrical substations. Either a huge coincidence, or maybe it really could be something. If Mr. Krull worked in the electrical industry, it makes sense that he would be in these areas. One victim was dropped off near the Bayswater electrical station, another was dropped off near a substation in Kew, and they both lived very near substations as well. Carmen also lived near one and was found near the Thomastown terminal station as well. My main question is like, how many substations are there? If there are only very few, then this is interesting. If there's loads of them sprinkled around the city, just 10 minutes apart each, then that's less interesting. As I said, this did come from a TV show, not from the police, so please do take it with a pinch of salt, but perhaps the police will follow through on it. They have narrowed their investigation down to just 7 suspects. I don't know if Norman is on that list, and they're still working through it, so I do have faith we'll get the answer someday, although the lack of any forensic evidence does throw a spanner in the works in this case. I have one final huge update before we get onto the identification of some Jane Does, this time in the case of the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders, a case I literally only covered last month, so it's crazy that I already have an update for you. I think I remember saying at the end of that video that the DNA evidence found at the crime scene was being retested, but I didn't actually expect anything to come from that for months, maybe for years. But it turns out this case has actually been solved, or at least the DNA has provided some answers. This case is from 1977, in which 3 young Girl Scouts were murdered in their tent on the first night at camp. And whilst a man was arrested and sent to trial, he was actually acquitted by the jury. This is a story that has split opinion hugely over the years. Many think that Jean Lee Rohart was racially stereotyped and used as a scapegoat by the local law enforcement, who always refused to look anywhere but him. Others have always been sure it was him. Turns out, it was, or at least probably was. The latest DNA testing in this case is officially inconclusive, but it strongly suggests that Jean Lee Rohart was involved and eliminates several other potential suspects. This information has actually been known by law enforcement since 2019, it seems, but they've been sitting on it until they were given permission by the families to share, as part of an upcoming ABC News documentary series about this case, which is expected to premiere around the 45th anniversary in the middle of June. The reason I say this DNA evidence is officially inconclusive is because no full DNA profile has ever been able to be developed in this case, but inconclusive doesn't mean useless. As I said, from this they've been able to eliminate other potential suspects, and as Mays County Sheriff Mike Reed has said, unless something new comes up, something brought to light we are not aware of, I am convinced where I'm sitting of Hart's guilt and involvement in this case. But whilst he is satisfied they had the right person in the form of Jean Lee Rohart all along, he said his ears are open and he will listen to what anybody has to say. I don't know if they'll ever get a conclusive answer here, but perhaps this is enough for the families. It's frustrating that they had him and he was acquitted of the crime, but he was actually in prison at the time for another violent crime and ended up dying just a couple of months later, so it's not like he went on to live a full, busy life. As I pondered in my original video, what's worse, letting an innocent man go to prison for the rest of his life, or letting a guilty man walk free? I don't know the answer to that. And then finally, we have a couple of quick updates in some Jane Doe cases. I have one identification that we'll end with, but we'll start with the smaller updates. So Opelika baby Jane Doe was found a decade ago near a trailer park in Opelika, Alabama, her body a partial skeleton. It's strongly suspected that baby Jane Doe was a victim of abuse and neglect, and her death was ruled a probable homicide. In November 2021, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children released updated forensic images of the child with a detailed description of her appearance and life. It's estimated that she died at some point between 2010 and 2011, but they're focusing in on the fall or summer of 2011. She was 4 to 7 years old with medium length black hair styled in cornrows. As I said, she had most likely been abused and was malnourished. A long sleeve pink shirt with heart buttons and small ruffles near the neckline was recovered near the body, but it's not ever been confirmed that it definitely belonged to her. Chemical isotope testing suggests that she was born and raised in Alabama or very close by. She likely had a visibly scarred left eye and was probably blind in it. The police are offering a $20,000 reward in this case and are urging anyone with any information, no matter how big or small, to contact them. Again, I'll leave the contact information down below. Othram are also in the process of genealogical testing for this case, so I have no doubt we will get answers soon, and I don't think they're going to be good. Which leads me very nicely onto the next update as well. Annandale Jane Doe is also undergoing testing with Othram, meaning her identity may also only be around the corner. The case of the Annadelle Jane Doe, or the Christmas Tree Jane Doe, as she is sometimes known, is fascinating, as it very much seems that she never wanted to be identified. There have been a lot of ethical questions raised surrounding any attempts made at her identification, both in the pro and con columns. Some say that her final wish should be respected, others say that her family deserves to have answers. But also, what if she didn't write the note claiming she didn't want to be identified herself? What if this was a homicide? There are questions that could be answered with her identity. As Major Ed O'Carroll, head of the Fairfax Police Major Crimes Bureau, has said, by all indications, it's not a criminal case, but it is an open case. In all honesty, I think they probably will find Annadelle Jane Doe's identity, but I don't think her name will be released to the public, so this might be all that we get in this case. Othram, as I've said many times, are an amazing company doing some amazing work at identification of does and providing answers in cold cases as well. And a lot of their work is crowdfunded, so please do go and check them out. It's actually thanks to a very generous donor that they were able to go over the mark in this case. And a lot of the time now in cases like this, the technology is there ready to provide answers. It's just the funding that provides a roadblock. And with that, let's round out the video with a very exciting Doe identification. Little Miss Nobody was another case I actually covered very recently in just February of this year, and her identity was revealed in March, over 60 years after her body was discovered. Hello, I've got a cat. Her remains were found burned and abandoned in the Arizona desert near Congress. I'm happy to announce that Little Miss Nobody was indeed Sharon Lee Gallegos. A theory that I did mention in my original video, but she was ruled out of the initial investigation due to uncertainty over the Jane Doe's age. Sharon was abducted from her grandmother's yard on the 21st of July 1960, just over a week before her body would be found in the desert. Although Sharon was ruled out as the identity soon into the investigation, in 2016 an amateur sleuth reached out to Sharon's older sister Ramona and said that he had met with a detective with the Alamogordo police and he strongly believed that Little Miss Nobody was Sharon. The next step was getting DNA from family members, to which Ramona agreed, but her DNA came back as inconclusive and she sadly died just a year later. It wasn't until Sharon's brother submitted his DNA and the identity... It wasn't until Sharon's brother submitted his DNA and the identity was confirmed and quickly announced in March after the testing was crowdfunded. But whilst Sharon's family finally know what happened to her and investigators have their name, that's not the end of this case. Now they have to find out who took her and killed her and bring justice. The only information around her abduction is that it's believed the abductors were in a dark green 1951 or 1952 Plymouth car. Sharon's remains, after being exhumed for testing, are still in the medical examiner's office whilst her remaining family decide where the best place for burial is. Her nephew, who she never met, said that the family have a deep appreciation for the people in Arizona that cared for her and crowdfunded to pay for the DNA test that identified her. Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes said that he was glad he did not let go until the unfortunate moniker of Little Miss Nobody could be finally removed from the headstone. So there you go, that is a very long case updates video for me. It seems crazy that that amount of new information could come out in just the few months since my last one. But that, like I said at the beginning of the video, is why we do what we do here. We want updates, we want answers. Thank you so much for watching. As I said, if you know any other information that I've missed out, please do put them in the comments down below. And I'll see you in the next one. Bye guys.